loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Last Wednesday, we had Judith Collins, the Minister for Science and Innovation, on the program, talking about the government's decision to lift the ban on GMO trials in the field. And to respond to that and inform us in an expansive way through his extensive knowledge as a genetic engineer, we've invited Jack Heineman, Professor in the School of Biological Sciences, University of Canterbury, Director of the Centre for Integrated Research and Biosafety, back on the program. Jack is on the UN's roster of biosafety experts and expert witness to the High Court on gene technology in 2013-14, which established that gene editing was genetic engineering. Jack, welcome back to RCR. Nice to have you this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, so maybe a bit of reaction if you heard Judith Collins last week and what she had to say. Was she out of her depth? Was she out of her league, Jack?
Well, it's sort of unfair. I mean, Judith isn't a scientist, so she has to just accept in many cases what her advisors or other and scientists are telling her, right? So you can forgive a minister for not having her finger on all the technical details. However, it is still her obligation to be sure that she consults broadly and credibly for anything she accepts as a fact that's going to underpin policy. She's already using words that are not credible. For example, she uses the word ban and moratorium. We haven't had a ban or a moratorium in New Zealand on the use of genetic engineering outside of the laboratory since the 1970s, except for a very brief period of time from 2001 to 2003 during the Royal Commission. All through this period, for which she's claiming there's been a ban or a moratorium, there has not been one.
Why do you think she claimed that? Thought. Why? Because you could argue that to sort of couch it in that way makes it sound like we've been overly restrictive and overly retentive and we're losing out to others, if you frame it in that way, just saying.
I do think that that is the tone. The idea being that we've made some kind of political or ideological decision to not use these organisms outside, and that the instrument for doing this has been the law. So I don't know actually what Judith Collins thinks, but the use of it that way is inescapably for listeners to think that there's been a world of wonder denied to them because of a political decision. I don't believe that that's the case. I think that it's useful to say that the reasons we don't have products of genome editing already commercially available is because of a ban, because then you don't have to explain why nobody in the world has really made any that make anybody any money, or why that because they don't work, or why they can't make them for a market large enough to make money. So I think that this really just hides a failure of genetic engineering for producing viable products, ones that would be suitable for New Zealand agriculture. And I also want to put aside the mixture of this of medicine and outdoor use of genetically modified organisms, because I think those are being used interchangeably as well to gaslight New Zealanders. There are no medicines not available to us because they're genome edited. We already have veterinary products and medicines that are genetically engineered organisms. So our regulations have not prevented access to them.
I pointed out to her, Jack, that mRNA is the greatest example of that. And there were no checks or balances or adequate testing, and it was a disaster. She just brushed me off, man.
Yeah, she did brush you off. But the but I think we need to set that issue aside because in many respects, it's entirely irrelevant to the types of products that she's talking about that would be used in agriculture or in conservation, to be used outside in the environment. All of the medicines are already regulated by separate instruments, and they're regulated around the world. The idea is, I think, that there's some complaint from some in the medical community, although I've not seen any research to validate their complaints, that the cost of our GMO regulations is hindering at-home development of some of these kinds of medicines. So once again, I've seen no verified evidence of this other than people complaining about it and surveys of people willing to complain, but not actually any costings. The only evidence I've ever seen for that premise has come from overseas, from the UK. And the UK has had a history of regulating genetic engineering the same way that we do. And already some 20 years ago, when they investigated the idea that GMO regulations were inhibiting people's accesses to new medicines because it was too expensive to develop them, they found that it wasn't true. Even medical researchers there conceded that it wasn't true, because the additional burden, when there is any burden at all, from the GMO regulations is redundant with other necessary regulations for quality assurance and development and intellectual property rights, securing intellectual property rights. So most people seem to be complaining about regulations as being a burdensome cost, but the evidence is that there are very few expensive regulations in addition to what you would have normally done outside of them being GMOs, such as using a contained laboratory facility, which you need to use in genetic engineering. But I'll get back to that, because this is a really important difference now from then. And it's a nice way to excuse yourself for never having made anything that's commercially viable in New Zealand.
And that's the primary argument, though, isn't it? That's why we're missing out, because we're not taking advantage of gathering our IP and then leveraging commercially off it. That's the whole argument.
Paul, I think that is the argument, and rightly so, that it is a ban that has prevented these products. But there is really no evidence that it's been that a ban would have, even if we had a ban, that it would have been the cause. Ultimately, no matter how much regulations cost a product for its development, they're only too expensive if your market is too small or if your product doesn't work very well. Yeah. That's when regulations are too expensive. Otherwise, regulations can easily be packaged into your development cost. But I also don't believe that the cost of GMO regulations has been onerous. And if I'm wrong, at least let's do the research to say what those would be and what are unique costs to the development of GMOs.
She gave me an example of an apple tree that, the exciting brave new world was, and she used the Cyclone Gabriel aftermath as an example where orchardists had lost copious amounts of apple trees, and it could be, you know, years and years before they're back up and running, because it takes that long to grow an apple tree to having harvestable apples. She kind of gave an example that must have been whispered in her ear by someone in a white coat, I'm thinking, that, you know, with this technology you could, and it was almost like she thought that this was in train, that this product was already, I guess you would call it a product, was already up and running in some sort of development phase of a tree that could grow in a year and then provide harvestable apples within a short period after that. And it seemed to me to be a Frankenstein concept, but also probably not true. What do you say about that?
Well, to be frank, I couldn't really tell what she was saying. So there wasn't enough detail in there for me to understand what this had to do with genome editing. Because after all, what she also said was, you can graft branches onto rootstock.
Oh, she did too, yeah. So
at any point, if you already have trees somewhere, you can branch, you can graft a branch on and have fruit that year, right? So I sort of suspect that what she was talking about was more the idea that it takes a long time with a long-lived organism like a fruit tree, like an apple tree, to breed new varieties. And that breeding time can be shortened using some techniques of genome editing. So that is something I'm familiar with as a claim for their use. But again, that we don't have those varieties is either because, one, genetic engineering, even using genome editing, isn't an effective way to develop them, or two, the market size for these novelty items, and I call them novelty items if they have a small market, the market size is too small even for modest or acceptable compliance costs in their development. And that's what I suspect is the real issue. If your market plan is to produce multicolored apple fruits, flesh fruits, and the way the market works is because of the different colors you can produce, that kind of novelty, people aren't going to pay that much for,
yep.
And they're going to get bored of whatever color is predominant at any given time. So you just need to change them rapidly. Well, if that's your market plan, then I'm really not going to trade biosafety for that kind of novelty.
Just going back to the bundling in of the medical side of this, that also is a sort of like a FOMO argument, isn't it? Fear of missing out. And that really touches people because they can visualize themselves missing out on a treatment that could save their lives or change something significant that they may have that's not available now. And again, that's just persuasion in the end. Is that the point you're making? Or was that one of the things you're thinking?
It is. Paul, do you know how many medicines worldwide are available from genome editing?
No.
In March this year, the first one was approved for market for commercialization, according to Nature magazine. One, worldwide. We are not missing out. And the costs of those medicines are what are going to determine our access to them, not our GMO regulations.
There seems to be a reverence of CRISPR, like some incredible thing, you know, this, I mean, I do a lot of audio editing, video editing, know about editing, and it can be incredibly powerful tool.
Yeah.
But is it a magical thing, Jack? CRISPR?
It is not a magical thing. It's just one of the techniques that we bundle together as genome editing. And let me make absolutely clear to your listeners, the techniques we call genome editing, we've had since the 1970s. They are not new. They are a type of technique that we call site-directed. So the reagents that cause the change in the genome have a directionality to them. They can be guided to the site in the genome that you want to change. And we've been able to do that since the 70s. It's just that in some species, the techniques have been very inefficient. And in particular, they're inefficient in plants. And that has been the major success story, if there is a success story, in GMOs, because the largest commercialized outdoor use of any GMO are the staple crops, such as corn, soy, and sugar beet, and canola. But that's it. So the genome, the fundamental principles of genome editing and its use have been available in bacteria, fungi, and even animals already by the late 1980s, early 1990s, in all three of those types of organisms. But the new techniques, such as CRISPR-Cas that you refer to, those have been a step change in efficiency, not a step change in safety, which is how it's like to be described using another gaslighting term, precision, but a step change in efficiency. I don't know, Paul, I don't know how old you are, but I can remember back as a youth trying to put two boards together with a screw. And in the 1970s, that screw generally had a slot head, and I had to use a handheld screwdriver
to
drive it through the boards.
Yep. And it was hard on the hand after a while. I remember that.
Yeah. And I often would strip the head.
Yep.
Well, it is calling CRISPR-Cas a new technology is like saying the invention of the electric screwdriver and its many attachments is a fundamentally new technology for holding two boards together. It isn't. You can use a different, bigger variety of screw heads to do it. And because of the power of the drill, you can do it faster. But ultimately, the boards are still going to be held together by a screw.
Gotcha.
That is the same thing for genome editing. Highly efficient, but it is exactly that attribute that also makes it highly efficient at causing effects that you don't want. So the vision here is more like these techniques are magnets than they're like a lock and key mechanism. The genome editors are guided to a place in the genome that they will bind to most strongly, has the most iron content, and attracts the magnet. But once the reaction occurs at that location, then any other place in the genome that has some kind of iron content will also attract the genome editor, and it will efficiently make a mutation in that location too, and so on and so on. But also, because the chemistry of getting the reagents inside of a cell have improved, they've become more efficient as well. You get multiple copies of these enzymes in every cell. And if one site is occupied by one copy of the enzyme, then the other copies go find these other sites that attract their attention to make those changes. So this is the problem with what I consider a gaslighting term, the use of the term precision to describe the biosafety attributes of genome editing reactions. They're efficient reactions. You can retrospectively precisely describe what happened when you use that genome editor, but they are not precise in the sense that they don't attack other parts of the genome at the same time.
Gotcha. And that's where unintended consequences can gush in, let's say.
That's right. And this is where also Judith Collins is perhaps showing her age in the same way that I'm showing my age. For the longest time, particularly in plants, the most efficient way to create a change in a genome was to do what we call transgenesis. So to introduce the DNA through a variety of means that precluded the efficient use of genome editors. We could do it in other organisms, but not in plants. And because those processes are still very inefficient, relatively inefficient, you need to do them in a laboratory. So we didn't invent these brilliant and highly contained laboratories for biosafety reasons. We use these laboratories because it's the only way to create an environment in which, because of the low efficiency of the chemistry, we can get and identify the intended change in an organism. We can get an individual that we wanted to get. If we tried to use those techniques outside, we would never find our organism because they're too inefficient. We'd have to do it over too big a scale. These new chemistries and new tools like CRISPR-Cas make the reaction so efficient that you can now do them outside. You can, as a field is growing, spray it with genome editors and cause that genetic engineering to occur outside of a laboratory in the outdoors. Already 5 years ago, in 2019, when we did a survey of the patent literature, we found a number of patents that are centered around that scalability of genome editing for outdoor use. In the United States, you have the first commercialized pesticide based on real-time exposures to tools that are similar to genome editing tools. Those tools are for gene silencing, but they're based on the same site-directed activity that we see in genome editing. These work in real time. The idea is that you spray a crop field with these tools, with these reagents, and the pests that eat the crop ingest those reagents. They're taken up into the cells of that organism and they kill it.
Okay.
Right. So when Judith says, "Don't worry, Paul, you're going to have the opportunity to buy or not buy."
Yeah, she did say that.
Products of genome editing, because they're done in a laboratory. Unless she makes it true that they have to be done in a laboratory, can only be used in a laboratory, then they potentially won't be.
That's a very important point I think you've just made. And I'm not the smartest or the sharpest knife in the drawer, but I think it's a very important point, because to get this technology outside of the lab, of course, you want the opportunity to be able to next level scale, like you've just described, in the environment. That's what it's about, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is, absolutely. A Monsanto patent from, I don't know, it was like 2018 or something, said it in no uncertain terms. The holy grail was scalability.
Yeah.
And that is what the techniques up until now failed to do. They couldn't scale. And in part, they couldn't scale because you were dependent on a laboratory, not for biosafety reasons, but for efficiency reasons. The changes make it now possible to scale in multiple dimensions at once. You can scale the size of the environment that you genetically engineer, and you can scale the number of species you genetically engineer at once, and you can scale the number of times you change the same organism, the same genome. So you can ultimately create changes that are every bit as dramatically different as using a transgene.
Wow. Okay, so that gets into another thing that I don't want to like make it all about her, but these are the points that have been made at this level of government. Another point was she seemed to be quite relaxed about, you know, the buffer zones that would be in place to stop any cross-pollination or cross-effect from anything, and you know, nothing really to worry about there. There'll be buffers there, or whatever the description she used. But how can you stop an insect? You know, how can you, you know, hem in an insect in a particular area? They're going to go off wherever they want, and there are millions of them.
Well, there's again, because she was talking in such vague generalities, It's hard to pin anything down. It's really going to depend on the biology of the thing you're looking at. Now, I assumed what she was referencing is things like genetically modified maize and how far their pollen flows for the possibility of causing admixture with other kinds.
That was the specific question I threw. Yeah.
And there is work on that. There are management strategies. But as you say, they're not all going to be, all of the kinds of things that are going to be made aren't just going to be ones that were made into a lab and then put out into the environment as a monoculture. They may be used in mixed culture, or they may have pathways of dissemination through the environment, which are not so easily contained as maize plants in the U.S. Midwest would be, for example. An example of a paper that describes some of the pathways you're talking about was, again, a pesticide, an insecticide in this case, based on a small oligonucleotide. So like your mRNA, okay, a small molecule that is based on DNA or RNA. And this molecule, when it's taken up by a target insect, silences some genes in that insect that causes a lethality. So it kills that insect as a result of ingesting that small RNA or DNA molecule. And in this experiment, what they did was they just put these small molecules in the water for the plant. The plant took them up through its roots. And as a result, those molecules were distributed throughout the body of this plant. The pest, some kind of aphid or something, munched on the plant and, as expected, died from exposure that was mediated from a puddle of water through the roots into the stem and leaves. They then added to this experiment a predator of the aphid, a wolf spider or something like this. And what they found was that the wolf spider eating the aphid, the cells around that wolf spider's stomach reacted to the insecticide that was supposed to be specific to the aphid, silencing genes in that spider's stomach and causing an adverse effect, but not killing the spider. So the spider is alive, it has a sublethal effect, and as you say, it can move away.
Yep.
It can transfer.
So that's how it can work. Right, I get it.
But there was one more surprise to this experiment. If the spider drank the guttation water, the water that comes out of the leaves, it died.
Oh, okay.
So the insecticide that was specific to the aphid wasn't so specific, and it can move through trophic ranges. And a trophic level distribution is an escape pathway.
Yeah. So to me, of course, the uneducated in this, it sounds more likely than not that that will happen.
It is something you can only get a chance of investigating if you're forced to investigate
okay.
it. So if we get rid of these regulations or soften the regulations, one of the things that, again, the minister is a little bit coy on, in my view, is she says anything that's still in the view of our regulator will be regulated and therefore will also be labeled. But what is unclear is how many types of uses of these genome editors will no longer be in scope of the legislation, because this tiered process effectively deregulates some uses. And if you deregulate those uses, you no longer trigger the regulations, and the regulator will have nothing to say and can impose no requirements for testing.
I want to get your comments on who really has a say here. Go back to the 2014 High Court ruling determining gene editing was a legal form of genetic modification. Then move to the Productivity Commission recommending in 2021 that our strict laws regulating genetic engineering be reviewed. Then we get to that report. Jody Brunning, who's been on the show before, sociologist, she says that the report obfuscates risk, doesn't represent what the bulk of submissions had been asking for. She said just 2 out of 80 submissions, both from the medical industry, there's the medical industry again, that fed into the Productivity Commission's 2021 report, argued that the hazardous substance and whatever it is, organisms, should be opened up. I should know that Hazardous Substances and New Organisms Act should be opened up. It seems like people can submit, and just 2 out of the 80 fed into the report. People don't seem to be listened to, and something of this consequence potentially should be a national conversation with every citizen, shouldn't it?
Well, I agree with you, because also there are elite organizations who are deciding for you what is a valid thing for you to be concerned about. And they're taking this page right out of the U.S. approach. And the U.S. in the 80s said the only thing that matters is safety in a biological sense. Everything else is socioeconomic and is just hiding a non-tariff trade barrier. So that is what you always get since then in these approaches. They will narrowly define what can be considered or what they will consider as a risk pathway, which excludes many of the concerns from a broad societal view. And then they will minimize those kinds of risks, or argue that they can be minimized in practice. Now, that's not necessarily wrong in all cases, but as you say, it is a narrow view of what's important to society when it comes to the use and release of these technologies.
Yeah, and I guess people have to be informed and educated about the issue, and that's a challenge too, isn't it? That's a real challenge. People go about their daily lives.
It's particularly a challenge for those who want to commercialize because ever since the 80s, that view has been called the knowledge gap. And so repeatedly, there have been efforts to educate people about the tools and the technology. And almost invariably, the more education the public gets, the less comfortable they are with the use of the technology. So that's backfired. That makes the use of, and I'll call it out, because I think the Royal Society publications from about 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, use this new technique. They create scenarios. And in framing these scenarios in a particular way, they limit solution space for participants or somebody who stumbles upon the scenario. And it sort of tempts them to a solution that's technological, and in particular, the technological solution of those who are proponents of using genome editing. So it's possible, in my view, that we would have really important, I mean, actually not novelty item important types of products of genetic engineering. I think that's possible. And I think there are examples as well, particularly in medicine. But you don't get there the wrong way. And you don't beat society up for having concerns. You actually give them a sense of trust that the hype behind this technology will not influence that evaluation of what's important for people in adopting any particular product.
Yeah, I hit her up on trust. And I used the rollout of the you-know-what as an example of that. That has destroyed trust. It really has, big time. And we can't ignore that. That shows that there's a willingness to, betray, a willingness. They've done it already.
Our society definitely looks to me, as a non-social scientist, to becoming more and more polarized. And again, it's outside of what I do. But I can't also help believe that it is an erosion of the trust in those who have power in society, an erosion of trust in experts, because we also haven't as carefully curated the possibility for experts to have an unconflicted career as we have curated the drive to make universities and crown research institutes the wellspring of intellectual property that will lead to licensing rents.
Yeah.
So the outcome seems to me unavoidably to be that you take the risk of people disengaging and not believing authority structures. Regardless of if we had COVID or not, I still think we would see the polarization or an increase in polarization of views in society. And we haven't developed tools to help people navigate why there are such polar differences in the use of any, as close as you can get to, objective fact. So we're left at the mercy of this kind of tension in society. And then we use authority to make a decision rather than consensus and trust to make a decision.
In terms of what's best for our country, and in this case, our country, and what you've been saying in our chat has got me thinking, there's no way of ever rolling over the top in terms of earnings, of export potential success with this technology compared to what we can do with the image that we have with food production now, mainly food production, because I think we're minnows when it comes to medical innovation, aren't we? We're tiny. We're never going to match the big economies there. But we have a well-established, and that was a lot of the feedback we got after that interview and in some of the discourse that's been going on, that we have an image. It's been hard won. It might not be perfect, but we're seen as a GMO-free food supplier to the world. We have high-value products. And if you're going to make a commercial argument, unless you can roll over the top of that with this, then we don't even really need to go there, do we?
Well, I'm not sure. And because, again, I'm a genetic engineer. I'm not an economist or a businessman. But from what you're saying, I see a lot of plausible truths. So, for example, New Zealand could be the site of invention of a plant that was super drought tolerant. So we don't have to necessarily invent something that's only going to be useful for New Zealand, right? So that's possible as a market strategy. The problem with it is that we've had 50 years of trying to make drought-tolerant plants using genetic engineering. And even in the most permissive countries in the world, such as the minister rattled off, like the United States and Canada and in general the Americas.
It was a who's who.
They haven't done it. and even to this day, the USDA speaks of nothing but only two traits, herbicide tolerance and insecticide-producing plants. It says that there are others, but they're so small in market and scale that it never even counts them as part of the U.S. market of genetically modified organisms. Genome editing is already only producing things like those two traits. And what happens then is that they're suited to high-intensive, large-scale monoculture agriculture that can dominate in places like the Americas, where there's a lot of land, or Australia, where there's a lot of land to grow your crops on, and not the highly integrated and complex agroecosystem that predominates in New Zealand, where every farmer is different and every crop is different over time. You don't just grow one thing only every year. Those kinds of products probably won't be things that make a big deal of difference to New Zealand. Yeah. And I also want to point out that New Zealand isn't falling behind in biotechnology. At most, it's not pursuing just one kind of biotechnology, genetic engineering, but it comes out on top of the world for all the other outcomes of its biotechnology. New Zealand wheat yields are always amongst the highest in the world, right? We don't need genetic engineering to do that. The same for our corn yields. We don't make genetically modified corn, but we produce really well in that. The same for dairy. So the point is that there are lots of biotechnologies, and in countries like New Zealand and in the European Union, where you have a bigger patchwork of agro ecosystems, those types of agricultural systems benefit more from an agroecological approach that treats outcomes such as drought tolerance, heat tolerance, and yield as a multifactored gene-nature interaction, which is optimized through changing and improving things like soil and water quality. Those systems don't benefit from this type of biotechnology as much as places in the Americas do.
I got that. Thank you. Just to wind up, I wonder if you think this push for deregulation, well, I think you're going to say it is happening globally. And if so, is it orchestrated? And are we being caught up in that? Are we part of that orchestration as well, do you think?
Yes. Well, I mean, there's evidence, right? We have the same industry organizations and franchises of the international industry organizations here. We have the same textbooks, and our scientists integrate through conferences around the world. The terminology, the approach to framing, you'll see these everywhere around the world, the same full court press everywhere. So there's very little novelty in what I see in the way the pressure is coming on government here in New Zealand from what I see in Europe or in Japan or in other countries that up until now have been fairly steadfast in the balances of biotechnologies they use and for the reasons they use them. So yes, and you know, the marketing power of the technological utopia that it promises, that narrative power is strong, particularly in times of uncertainty. Climate change creates a great deal of uncertainty and anxiety, as did COVID. And you want that reassurance of someone who says that they have the magic pill.
I think that's a great note to end on, Professor Jack Heinemann. Really interesting, man. Thank you so much. Really interesting chat.
Thanks for having me.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.